Well, I'm very pleased and greatly honored to have this chance, and particularly to talk to an audience which knows much more than me, I guess, about many of the complications arising from gender economics. My purpose today is something slightly different. It is to set the general background of what is the nature of this crisis and how it should be viewed, and then come at the end, if possible, a little bit on the policies and the gender issues. Well, to start to make it very schematic, you know, there has been a general sort of sport among economists to compare what is, you know, how it compares with the Great Depression of the 1930s, 1929, the crisis which started. One of the very influential paper was written by Paul Krugman. It was a popular paper in which he said it is really half a depression compared to the 1930s, statistically speaking, for the United States. Very soon there was a second paper from Eichen Green and O'Rourke from IMF saying that, yes, it's a very short crisis so far as it's not as deep a crisis so far as the United States is concerned as yet in the first 14 months, but it is actually a much deeper crisis in a comparison of the first 14 months insofar as the global situation is concerned. And in this, you take basically three things, and the fourth thing I'll come to: industrial production. The international drop, the global drop, has been much stronger than in the 1929, now 14 months. Stock market prices, on an average, the drop, and the volume of world trade, which is one of the main transmission mechanisms we talked about. Employment drop and employment statistics usually comes with a lag, but from whatever we have, it is quite clear that the crisis is at least, I repeat, at least of the same magnitude internationally. And about the United States, the statistics is probably still a little bit less than what it was in 1929. Now, at one level, it's easy to understand. The world is much more globalized, so the impact of the crisis today is much sharper globally than it was in 1929. The globalization of finance, the globalization of trade, obviously gives the crisis much more of a global character. But it also raises a paradox, the first paradox of prediction about economics, that most people had been talking, and still today they talk, both in the Congress, outside, everywhere. The typical thing is to say that America is the greatest, you know, debtor in the world. It has borrowed from the world far too much. So there is a dollar crisis hanging. So many people had been saying for years, at least since the late 1980s, that a dollar crisis is going to break. The people who have lent to the United States, in some way, there is going to be a run on confidence on the US dollar. The crisis did not happen that way. There is a dollar crisis. Probably it will happen sometime later. It might happen, might not happen. That's speculation. But certainly the dollar crisis did not take place in spite of the global character of this crisis so far in terms of the real economy. The second thing which is interesting is many of us, including at the Levy Institute, myself included, we wrote papers and we looked at statistics and so on, saying, one of my old friends, Wynne Godley, was one of the first one to go at it in a big way, that it is the consumer's debt which will trigger off the crisis, the increasing burden of consumer debt. It played a part, but the crisis really did not quite come from consumer's debt. If you follow it very carefully, what happened rather is something which we all vaguely thought, but not being insiders to the financial sector, we could not stick out our neck and say, was a small consumer's debt default crisis, the so-called subprime crisis in the United States, set off a crisis in finance of unprecedented magnitude, collapse of confidence, bankers not wanting to lend to one another, and so on and so forth. Flight of money, which nobody mentioned in the morning, but one of the most important things, flight of money took place from many of the developing countries, from the stock markets, plunging the stock markets there, and generating a large global crisis in the stocks and so on. Now, this element of having the, you know, the crisis could have happened either because, thank you, the crisis could have happened either because of dollar, drop, a sharp drop in the dollar, hard landing of the dollar. The crisis could have happened because of a huge default on consumer debt. And the crisis could have happened because of basically an evaporation of confidence of the banks. It is a third thing which happened to some extent triggered by the second. Now, this whole idea of this financial crisis, which basically started with the banking sector in the United States and then reverberated through the rest of the world, has a second paradox in it, which is almost, you know, never talked about in the US among the US economists otherwise, but it's actually quite almost ironical. You see, what actually happened in 1929 crisis, the big depression, after which, when the Keynesian economics was being overthrown by the Chicago school led by Milton Friedman, in a very influential book which many of you might know, Milton Friedman and Schwartz, basically said that the 1929 crisis, the triggering off of the crisis, was almost entirely because of the Federal Reserve System's over-regulation, over-strictness. That was one of the main theme of the book, that the Federal Reserve over-regulated and precipitated the crisis. They went against another famous American economist, that's Irving Fisher of Yale, who had said that, you know, exactly like what we heard 2 years ago. Fisher had said that new techniques have been developed, new, you know, risk management techniques have been developed, and now there is not going to be a crisis. What we see, the high prices of stocks, is going to last indefinitely. The world, if I remember from memory, has more or reached a new plateau of high prices of stocks. It took 2 weeks before the real crisis started. And this is the crisis which Friedman said could have been averted if the Federal Reserve did not overregulate. Now, today, when the second crisis happened of a similar nature, where the banking crisis was at the center, you hear the opposite. Almost the chorus among everybody, you are almost totally out of fashion to say that the crisis is because of under-regulation. Now, there is a considerable element of truth, just like in Friedman's statement was also, there is a considerable element of truth. But, you know, half-truths can be more misleading than straight lies. To think of this crisis as something which has been entirely brought about by under-regulation of the system, and otherwise the system is working fine, I think is a very widespread belief, particularly in the United States among macroeconomists, and it is false. We have been saying it for many years, it is false. The reason why it arises is what in economics is known as the monetarist Keynesian controversy. You see, the basic idea, we do not need to go into the theory, you know, the jargons and so on. Basic idea is that real economy functions reasonably well, very well as a matter of fact, and money is a kind of veil which occasionally disturbs you, you know, what Lucas would have said, a transient disturbance, but actually it comes back automatically on its own. This has been the basic framework. To this was added a financial system, perfectly working financial system, which was the Fama and all these people, who basically started by saying, well, again, we need not go into it, but the rational, efficient market hypothesis, that prices reflect the all available information to the maximum extent possible. This was the main theorem. And on this basis, it was claimed that, you know, since the market contains all the information, you cannot improve on it. So what was the orthodox, what was the, you know, crux of it? The crux was to say that you cannot improve on the market, which was actually the Chicago School's main information theory. You cannot improve on the market because the market processes all information, whether in the real economy or in the financial economy, much better than individuals can do. So, current chairman of the Federal Reserve System, the one before that, they all are on record for having denied that the high rise in prices could basically be because of any kind of what we talk, say, speculation or kind of bubble. That is not possible. It is basically because the market will not allow this to continue for very long by contradicting information. This was further strengthened by another classic argument from Milton Friedman, which said that speculators will lose money. And I think this is important for me to come to the main thing in a few, you know. And speculators will, you know, lose money because real speculators, if will sell when the prices are high, will buy when the prices are low. So when the prices are high, they sell, prices come down. When prices are low, they buy, so prices go up, so price will tend to stabilize. Much earlier, this was Friedman's classic argument. The argument, apart from empirical evidence and so on, which I would not go into, is false for a very simple reason. And we now know why it is false, logically. It is false because if speculators speculate, not only on the level of price, but on the price trend, and that is what speculation is all about, that you expect prices to rise, so you buy. You expect prices to fall further, so you sell, in which case it will exaggerate rather than decrease the amplitudes, the fluctuations. And this is what was being denied by conventional wisdom of finance. Even though they're living amidst that, many of them, if you read the books today, they were doing that every day themselves, that you buy, sell, the high speed of buying and selling, but this is what was being denied. In the process, so you got it here, you know, you got a system, you developed a financial system, which had two or three basic characteristics. One, you allowed a very, you know, you had a, what, you know, what is called a lender of the last resort. You had a banking system which had lender of the last resort and laws to protect the deposits of relatively small depositors in the United States and in other countries also. But this did not exist for a very large shadow banking system, which lent, borrowed, which dealt with money and so on, but they were neither protected by a lender of last resort, nor were they regulated by a lender of last resort. So you had this system. To just give you one bit of statistics, depository banking, this is in the last report of the president, economic report of the president of the United States, that from 54 to 23, the depository bank's asset came down. The assets of mutual funds, the assets of security brokers and others, a mysterious category, it went up from virtually nothing, less than 1%, to something close to 20%. Now, this kind of huge change from traditional banking to shadow banking was the first element, without any guarantee that if they're in trouble, money should be given by the, you know, by a central banking authority. The second element of this was they had to do something. They had to carry on their banking business, their lending business, and so on. They did this by creating a surplus system of credit among themselves. Mutual guaranteeing, it has various names, credit swaps, debt default swaps, you know, collateral mortgages, which could then be sold, so on and so forth, hundreds of different things. But basic idea was that you mutually guarantee each other's loans. But there is no hierarchical structure where at the top somebody is going to deposit. So basically you had a surplus system, and when it works, that is when on expansion, credit expands very rapidly because you can just guarantee each other's credit, and this is what happened. When it goes in the reverse gear and when it contracts, it also contracts equally fast. The one person to see it very clearly after having lost a lot of money and earned it was Warren Buffett, the richest man in the world, I'm told. That he said that this is a, you know, correlation. This is a correlation which will very quickly go down, you know, once the thing goes in reverse gear and so on. So basically, we actually have a situation where, and third, they had very large leverages and so on, which many of you know, guaranteed by. So you had circular finance or circular trade dependence. You had no lender of last resort, and you had a very highly leveraged system, which made the system extremely vulnerable, whose result we see. Now, the real economy comes in here in a very simple way, and I will end by, not simply because banks don't lend. This is where the mistake arises, and this is what, you know, financial journalists make it out to be, and some economists. Basically, the problem arises from a completely different source. The problem arises because, you know, when the credit expands and prices rise, wealth of household rise, and you maintain, to a large extent, at least in the United States, your effective demand through the capital, to the wealth effect of households. There are enough studies, I would not go into it and so on. So you maintain consumption demand, consumption expansion, by basically allowing expansion of wealth of the households. But households cannot, and this is the first paradox of finance, households cannot actually realize these gains. They can only realize these gains by taking debt. Because if everybody tries to realize by selling their assets, there would be a collapse, obviously, you know, in the stock market. So actually you take debt, so on the one hand, wealth increases, your creditworthiness increases, and your debt increases. And this is where the cycle actually comes in. The cycle comes in. You have increasing debt of households, which is they're increasing wealth, which increases consumption. And as the debt increases, you also have a lowering effect on consumption. This effect of the stock of debt, so you have a flow effect and you have a stock effect, so to say. The flow of debt and the stock of debt. The stock of debt does not matter very much for various ways, from simple to complicated, when prices are rising. Because in real terms, the debt effect is small. When prices fall, the debt effect is doubled. So the economy goes up, working with rising wealth and more consumption and an expansion. We could show this even with a sort of vague differential equation. Goes up, and then it begins to turn back when a large enough debt begins to pull you down. Large enough effect begins to pull you down. And the economy, in a certain way, like a giant oscillator, oscillates between this rising wealth effect, which is a flow effect, and a strong stock effect, which is the total stock of debt effect. And this operates, and this is the special of this, it operates within two boundaries. On the one hand, you reach the boundary where you have what is called Ponzi finance. Banks get nervous that too much has been lent to households. And, you know, this is not sustainable for various versions of Ponzi finance, transversality conditions, and so on. And when you are on the downswing, you are on the other side of the boundary, which is what you call the debt deflation of the Arvig Fischer type. That you have to sell off your assets, like what we are seeing now. You have to sell off your assets and so on to meet your debt obligations. So you have a large oscillation of the economy between this Ponzi finance and credit crunch. And, you know. Well, I know it is a little bit fuzzy because I tried to make it very short and tried to talk about it, but this is basically what it is. And if there is any equilibrium in this kind of a market economy, I'll end by saying this, we should get used to the fact that it is much closer to an oscillation with this as the natural phenomenon. It is not human greed, it is not over-regulation, and so on. And if we want to regulate, we should regulate by starting with the assumption that finance and real economy work in a way which will accentuate oscillation rather than reduce it.